Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today we're joined by a name synonymous with adventure, exploration, and a deep passion for the great outdoors. Julia Bradbury's love affair with nature began at a young age, nurtured by family hikes and camping trips in the rugged landscapes of the Peak District. She started her TV career as a showbiz reporter for Breakfast TV in LA, becoming a household name as the presenter of BBC's Country File alongside co-host Matt Baker. Her boundless enthusiasm for the countryside endeared her to audiences across the UK. She's perhaps best known for turning her lifelong passion for walking into primetime TV with shows including Britain's Best Walks, Cornwall and Devon Walks with Julia Bradbury, and Wainwright's Walks in the Lake District. But Julia's thirst for travel extends far beyond the borders of Britain, and over the years she's embarked on countless adventures to some of the world's most remote and awe-inspiring destinations. Her travel diaries today take us from Greece to South Africa, Iceland to Costa Rica. I also really enjoyed talking to Julia about health and well-being on this episode. She has a huge wealth of knowledge that she accumulated while writing her Sunday Times bestseller, Walk Yourself Happy, and also because of the lifestyle shift she herself adopted after being diagnosed with breast cancer, for which she underwent a mastectomy in 2021. So I think you'll find this an inspiring, interesting, energizing, and hopefully wanderlust-inducing conversation. So without further ado, let's get started. Julia Bradbury, welcome to the Travel Diaries. It is so lovely to see you. How are you?
Oh, Holly, finally we get to do this. I'm really, really, I'm good, thanks. And I'm very happy to talk about all things travel with you because I think we are kindred spirits. I think we both love travel, but there are lots of other little points that we'll probably touch on that we share as well.
Absolutely. I've been doing a Julia deep dive in the last couple of days. And like you say, there is just so much I'm excited to chat about. We have a lot of ground to cover, both on foot and by plane, don't we?
We do. And that's good because we're both good walkers and good travellers. So there we go.
I really think we should probably get started with your travel diaries, kick off, because we're going to go through a journey through the seven chapters of your life. And we begin right at the very beginning with chapter one, which is a great point to start, your earliest childhood travel memory, because I know that travel played an important part in your childhood.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably a little bit misleading because my earliest travel memory is Greece. And that makes it sound like, you know, as a family, we traveled a lot all of the time. And we didn't, because we're a very comfortable family, but we didn't do lots and lots of international travel. However, you'll know, having done your research, that my mum is Greek, that my great grandparents came over here 120 years ago to the United Kingdom from the island of Chios, or Chios, as my mum always tells me to say it.
So what pronunciation on the key?
Yes, it's the he. It's like the Greeks go, he, there's a lot of he in this. Yeah. I remember very distinctly not going to Chios, funnily enough, but my grandmother, my yayay, she ended up back in Greece. So her parents traveled over to the UK and landed in Wales. And then she had quite a complicated love life. And one of her husbands, she had a few, one of them was Greek, and she ended up back in Greece. And she ended up in a tiny little village called Aia Marina. And there are many little villages called Aia Marina in Greece, just outside Athens and further away than a beach resort called Vouliagmeni. And she lived a very modest life with her husband Yorgo, and they lived on it was like a little patch of land, and they had a shipping container, which was way before shipping containers were trendy. It literally was a shipping container because that's all they could afford, and that was one of their rooms. And then Yorgo had built this hodgepodge sort of low-level bungalow, And he was not great at DIY. So I always remember that the windows, one of the windows was upside down and inside out. So you could climb in from the outside of the building with, you know, the window lever and everything was, it was just there sort of to let you in. So that always made us laugh. So that is one of my earliest travel memories. We went with my sister and me and my mum and dad, Michael and Chrissy. So it's Michael, Chrissy, Jean and my sister and I. We went on a family holiday. We stayed in the shipping container, all of us, and Yorgo and Yayay were in their little low-level bungalow with the wrong-facing window. And it must have been July because it was my birthday. And I remember very distinctly that I was given the most exciting gift on my birthday. My sister gave me one blue flipper. And then my parents gave me the other blue swimming flipper. And that was for our daily jaunt down to the ocean, down to the sea, which was about a 10 minute walk from the house. We'd walk down the hill, a dusty track, and we'd land there. It was nothing fancy at all, just a really, you know, local lovely beach full of the yayays bobbing around and the young Greek boys doing their thing, and there was a, you know, souvlakis and all of that stuff.
Oh, it sounds idyllic though.
Yeah, it really, really was special. And I remember being in the water, bobbing around in the water with my mum, and I would have been, you know, even three. So really, really, I can't give you details apart from that, but just remember feeling very, very happy. Remember the sunshine. I always remember the walk, because the walk for me, that was so long for little legs, 10 minutes down the hill. That was a big deal. And if we were lucky, Yorgo had this little white van that it sounded as if it ran on batteries. It was like, and he would come and pick us up at the end of the day. And that, I was always very grateful for that, because it meant that we didn't have the walk up the hill.
Up the hill, right. And it sounds as though, you know, Greece has really played an important part throughout your life, and you know, even like the names of your children being kind of Greek names, like obviously it holds a special place in your heart. Definitely.
Oh, it really does. And it's, you're pretty hard pressed to talk to anybody who doesn't love Greece if they've been there. There really, yes, is a magic to the Greek islands and to the hospitality and to the way of the Greeks. And one of my proudest working moments from a professional point of view is when I came up with an idea for a Greek travel series to include my mum, and for us to go back to Greece and explore all that's good about Greece, you know, how they've contributed to the English language, philosophy, walking. There was a peripatetic school the ancient Greeks used to attend to and discuss philosophy while they walked. So I wanted to do a series that encapsulated all of that and all the lovely cultures of, you know, the groups of women who get together to make honey or sesame desserts together, all the yayays who in Chios, actually, where I'm from, Chios is famous for mastika. And mastika is a gum and it's edible, but it's also mastic glue. It can be turned into a glue, the kind of glue that you find around the edges of your bath. So apart from, well, Greece is the primary source of mastika, and it comes from the tree, and it's a very intricate harvesting method, because it's not from the tree, it's not a fruit from the tree itself. What happens is the bark of the tree is cut in a particular way, and then the mastika, the gum, seeps out of the bark and then falls to the ground, and there's a special powder that they put on the ground which helps collect and harvest those droplets of mastika gum that then go hard. And then they get taken up the hill to, in Chios, to these beautiful, it's a sort of a labyrinth of very small, narrow pathways. And all the yayas' job is to get together, they sit outside and they sift through the mastika together. And they get the leaves and the foliage, and they basically get it, it's sort of the pre-processing, it's before it goes to the factory to get turned into whatever it's going to get turned into, which also, by the way, is full of Greek yayas. But it's that pre-moment, and they sit outside and they eat, and it's a social thing. And it just is one of those, there's a lot about blue zones at the moment, and there are a lot of images.
I was about to say that, yeah.
There are a lot of images. And Chios isn't a blue zone, although there is one in Greece. But it should be, because this is the essence of their life. You know, they're in their 80s, 90s, 100s. They sing, they chatter, and they're doing this productive work together. And to pull that whole series together, we managed to get the show commissioned. We got finance. It just all concertinaed together. And it was the most edifying professional experience. And I got to film with my mum in Chios. Oh, so yeah, it was brilliant.
And is Chios an island that is kind of on the tourist trail?
It's not really, but it should be because it has a lot to offer. It's got these big, beautiful windmills. It's very picturesque. I mean, look, it's not geared up for tourists. And if you're looking for an action holiday and you're looking for loads and loads of things to do, then Chios isn't the place for you. But if you want somewhere very gentle to relax, and you know, you want to, maybe if you go at the right time, you'll see the yayas doing their bit with the mastika. It's very beautiful, and I certainly would recommend it. It's historically, it was a port. It was a very, very busy port. I don't know where it lies now in the, you know, in the global scheme of how efficient it is and how much money it makes through that. But certainly it has a history and is very beautiful and definitely is worth a visit.
Looking at it, it's nearer to Turkey than it is to Greece mainland, isn't it?
Yes. And there's a lot, obviously, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between the Turks and between the Greeks. And obviously, there's a lot of bad history and good history. And you'll eat something in Greece, like a halva or a baklava. And the Greeks will obviously claim that it's theirs. And then the Turkish go, no, it's ours. You know, that's ours. We came up with that. And the same with hummus and the breads and all of that. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about where these foods originated. And the honest truth is it's from both places, isn't it? It's a combination. That's how food migrates around the world. Every little place it moves to, it picks up another ingredient perhaps or another flavor, or the local way is introduced.
Were there any other islands that you discovered on that Greek Islands series that surprised you?
Well, this is definitely a more popular destination. But for me, Skiathos was an absolute revelation. Mm. The reason it's a more popular destination is because Skiathos has an airport. So it means it's more accessible. And a lot of people listening might have been to Skiathos. I hadn't been to Skiathos and its surrounding islands, but we had one of the most incredible filming experiences there, where we got on board a fishing boat with these two incredible fisherman brothers. And they took us all around the local beaches. And what they do is they teach you to fish. And they have got one of the last five remaining fishing boats from a fleet of thousands. Unfortunately, it's an industry that has completely been destroyed because of pollution, because of overfishing. So they've sort of become eco-tourism specialists, these fantastic two brothers. And what they do is they take you out and they teach you to fish and they talk about how it used to be and they show you how the boat works and then they cook for you and then you jump off the boat and you go diving for sea urchins and then they take you to another island where there are these goats that you can feed and the goats come up and you feed them and you jump off the boat and the waters are crystal and it's an absolutely magical experience. And I was so taken by it that I wanted to take my family back there. So I did end up taking my young daughters and my son and my partner. And we went back to see them. And we all together then had the most magical experience. And the children fished and they learnt about this trade. And then you eat this incredible meal that Yanis prepares for you. So he cooks a fish over the side of the boat. He's got this little makeshift barbecue.
Oh, and then they
create these incredible Greek salads covered in rosemary and all the lovely herbs with a big slice, a big loaf of their local bread with smothered in olive oil. And you just basically dine like kings and queens, but sitting with the food on your lap on a boat, surrounded by this incredible scenery and the water lapping up against the boat. And it's magical.
It sounds so perfect.
And the boys always, that we're still in touch, and they send me honey. They send me Greek honey sometimes. We always swap messages. They send me messages of them when they're fishing in the winter, which is obviously a very different proposition. And they're forever grateful because people still go and they all go, we want to do the trip that Julia did. And they've got a picture of me and them up on the jetty, and you know, come and do Julia Bradbury's little tour, which is I absolutely
add me to the
love.
List, please.
Yes, go. Yes, absolutely. I'll put you in touch with them. They are just they're lovely, and it's a magical experience. And Skiathos and Skopelos are gorgeous islands as well, and very worth a visit. And of course, Skopelos is famous because it's where Mamma Mia was filmed, and you can go to the lovely church, and you know, and you go up the 110 or 112 steps, whatever it is, and you ring the bell at the top. So they two more special places. And obviously, if you do make that hop to Skopelos, then it's that much smaller. There isn't an airport, so you'll be experiencing again a different kind of life because it's not as accessible. And I find, and I'm sure you do when you travel, the less accessible places are, the more interesting they are, because it you know, takes a journey to get there.
Yeah. Without doubt. Well, it sounds like you certainly fell in love with Skiathos. Chapter 2 is the first place that you fell in love with.
Right.
Where comes to mind for that?
Well, this is quite easy, actually, because I made friends in my 20s with a group of South Africans in London. And I can't remember, I don't know if we were out clubbing or I met one and then they introduced me to another one. Anyway, it turned out this group of South Africans were all somehow connected. They'd done army service together, or they were cousins, or so they were a tribe. And we just got on so well. And we'd hang out together, and we would go clubbing together, and we'd go picnicking. And South Africans and Australians, when they come to the UK, they want to travel. They want to experience life, because generally what they're doing is they're here to experience the UK and Europe, and then they're going to go back home, and they're probably never going to travel again. Mm-hmm. That's how it works for a lot of people, because they're living in such faraway places and such big places. And from South Africa's point of view, it's very expensive. If you're a South African, traveling to Europe and the rest of the world is phenomenally expensive because of the rand and, you know, the cost ratio. So as a result, I think that, you know, if you become friends with a group of South Africans in their 20s, you've got them on full flight adventure mode. So then I went to South Africa with them and I fell in love. Absolutely fell in love. The big skies, the pink sunsets, the bush, the African bush veld, Cape Town, those wild beaches, the food, the 12 different languages, the cross-section of different African cultures. Just, it's a magical, magical place. And it's very interesting. And it's always teetering on the brink of disaster. You know, ever since I've been going there, everything's going to go horribly wrong this year. You know, and you can see the change it's gone through. It's made really positive change, and it's made some terrible negative change as well. And it's sad, actually, because I think the problem that South Africa now is this adjustment, post-apartheid, this adjustment to a new democracy is not easy. It's not an easy transition. It takes a lot of skill. You do need a lot of political goodwill, and that doesn't exist all over the country. And also there's a lot of bad blood. You know, there's a lot of bad feeling because of things that have happened in the past that have been completely unfair and outrageous towards a lot of the African people. So there is, quite understandably, there's a real feeling of discord there, and that is very, very hard to get through. And I think it's going to take maybe another 100 years for that to happen. So meanwhile, we live in this constant state of flux of, is it all just going to go to hell? Or is it going to come right? Is somebody going to come into power that sees a way through all of this and can make this system work? So we live in hope, but you can never take away the beauty of the country and the landscapes. And I've been lucky enough to have, I can't tell you, I mean, I go so regularly because I try and see my friends often, and I go for a reset and a reboot when I'm there. So I've done walking safaris across the Kruger National Park. I've been that tourist in Cape Town. I've been the not tourist visiting my friends up the East Coast, in places called Fleurs Bay and Mossel Bay, and spent time with them in their homes. I've traveled across South Africa, by car. So I've really seen a lot of it at different levels, and I never tire.
Would you say that for a first trip, would you do
kind of Cape Town and kind of stick around that area in the garden route? Or would you say that you have to kind of do that internal flight to get up to Joburg and fit in the safari element as well?
Well, there are, you've got the Shamwari Reserve, which is close to Port Elizabeth. And there are other safaris that are accessible from Cape Town, but the majority are Botswana and a lot of the exciting ones. So yes, it's that internal flight to Joburg and then you hop on another little flight, or you can drive out of Joburg to get to some of those other safari destinations. And of course, I would recommend the safaris because it's the big five. You get to see, yeah, you know, the lions, the leopards, the elephant, the water buffalo and the rhino.
Okay. I'm going to get there, Julia. I'm going to
go
get there.
Go for it. See? Of course you will. You're Holly from the Travel Diaries. You're going to get everywhere eventually.
I hope so. So of course, so many of us know you from your fabulous walking series, and it sounds as though walking has just been an integral part of your life since you were a child, that your dad would take you on walks in the Peak District after school.
That's right. Yes, I grew up in Rutland in Leicestershire and part of the time in Sheffield where I went to my secondary school. And my dad is a Tideswell born and bred man, and he spent his childhood running wild across the Peak District with his brother Stuart, my uncle Stuart, who curiously lives in South Africa, and I see him a lot when I go to South Africa. So that's how they spent their childhood. And not that I had exactly the same type of childhood, but my dad, Michael, was definitely committed to making sure that I had an appreciation and an understanding of the great outdoors and nature and how important nature is in our lives. And we started walking when I was about six together. And a lot of that time was spent walking across the Peak District. And then obviously, as I got older in secondary school, we would spend weekends or after school, even you could make a dash and get out to some of those locations. So Stanage Edge and Haddisage and Buck, Buxton, Mamtor, those kinds of places. So walking really, really has been a part of my life from a very young age, and it has stuck with me as a tool for life. And I would recommend walking to everybody for all sorts of reasons, for your mental health, for your physical health, for improved memory, to help ward off disease, and also just that very important thing of getting out into nature. And for those of your listeners who have mobility issues, being outside in a wheelchair or in some sort of device, if you haven't got full mobility, being outside on its own is still profoundly beneficial. We human beings need daylight. We create our own vitamin D, and we need the daylight into our eyeballs. And we do not get that sitting inside with our indoor lighting. We also have an appreciation, an innate appreciation, because of the way we've evolved outside, of the color green. We understand and see the color green. That's what made us such good foragers, because we could see the berries in the green. Everything makes sense when you field it back to how we have evolved. And what we haven't evolved to do is to spend all our time inside, underneath artificial lights, at screens, sitting down. That's not what humans have evolved to do. And it's impossible for us to have made these changes and to have evolved in the 50 to 100 years where we have started this incredibly sedentary, different life. So I'm not joking when I say it is imperative to human health to be outside every day. It is imperative to human health to move. And to move in different ways, you know, to squat, to walk on all fours, to climb the stairs on all fours, to do different things with your body, because that's what we used to do. And if you want to maintain mobility, if you want to enhance health span and longevity throughout your life, there are a few golden rules. And one of them is daily outdoor exposure and a connection to nature. And the other is sleep, and the other is good nutrition.
And you cover these topics within your book, Walk Yourself Happy. And since I was reading it, like, I've been making a much more conscious effort to get that morning light, like you say, into my eyeballs. Yep. But it's interesting, isn't it, how as a society we've just come so far away, and it frustrates me, and I wonder if it frustrates you, that it's seen as like alternative or like hippie to kind of abide by some of those very fundamental principles that you talk about.
Yeah, and I talk about grounding quite a lot on my Instagram feed and on my other social media platforms. And grounding is when you walk barefoot in the grass, and grounding is what you do when you're on a beach, by the way, you know, on holiday. And I always say to people, you know, why do you think you feel so good when you're on holiday? It's not just because you're away. Yes, of course, that plays a role. You can de-stress, and that's very important. You can do that at home. You can do breath work. You can do meditation. We can. There are tools and techniques to de-stress ourselves. But I genuinely believe that one of the reasons why we feel so good on holiday is because we're in the daylight. We're in beautiful sunshine, most of us, or a lot of us, when we're on.
Spending far more time outside normally. Yeah.
You are outside and you're barefoot. And you are swimming in the sea. You're grounding all the time. You're swapping electrons with Mother Earth. And that's not woo-woo. Of course the Earth is full of energy. Of course it is. It's spinning around in the galaxy on its own. How does that happen? You know, if you can understand that concept, then it's not woo-woo. It is gravity. It's science. It's what's actually happening. You know, we're slowly spinning around on an axis and the forces of gravity at play. And we know that there are electromagnetic fields. So if we know all of that, then why is it so weird that grounding is a thing and that it can be beneficial to us? It can help with inflammation. It can help with sleeping. It can relax you. It can recharge you. It's sort of like a massive antioxidant tool, if you like. So I ground as often as I can. Even in the winter, I've got grounding flip-flops, and I go and stand in the scotchy mud and put the flip-flops on and just wash my feet afterwards.
How long do you do it for, out of interest?
Well, you're meant to do it for about 20 minutes. So sometimes I can combine it with some breath work, or maybe it is part of my walk, you know, walking barefoot. If I can do it. If I can only do 5 minutes, I'll do 5 minutes. But it's amazing how good I feel after 5 minutes. Really, really
tangible
difference. And I had a lady who wrote to me after reading Walk Yourself Happy. And she said to me, thank you. She basically, her email was, thank you, you've saved my life, which is an incredible heading to get from somebody. One of the things that I remember, she had this whole long list of stuff that she's adopted and she's doing. And she said, it's really made a difference in her life. She gets terrible migraines and she always just used to pop the pill, take the paracetamol or whatever it would be. She said, now I think about you. I stick my head out the window, because I always say, if you can't get outside, stick your head out the window. Look at some green, look at the trees, look at the clouds, take in some breaths. She said, I do that. And my headache 9 times out of 10 goes away, and I've stopped popping the pills.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I had a really interesting podcast interview with Heston Blumenthal, who is also very kind of aware about these kind of things. And I was saying how with some of my pain symptoms, when it's a full moon, they are heightened.
Yes.
And again, when I've told people that, they think I'm a complete nutcase. But actually, when you think about how the moon governs the tides, and, you know, it's no surprise, and why animals go wild when it's a full moon.
Yes, I mean, the moon literally is like a little bit of elastic, and it pulls the tides in and pulls the tides out. That is the power of the moon. So why wouldn't it affect all animals on Earth and nature and greenery and things that grow? I've recently become a convert to sound therapy in the past couple of years. So sound waves are very, very important. And of course, they vibrate through our entire body. I've had a bit of an iffy hip. And when I'm in my sound therapy session with the lovely Lisa Pawley, who we'll talk about my retreats in a moment, she's coming on our retreat. When I'm in those sound therapy sessions, she works these crystal bowls and creates these incredible tones. And she knows, like, that's a C and that's a D sharp and that connects the thyroid and that's to do with your liver. And that's, she's phenomenal. She's so instinctive. And my hip vibrated in the last session. And there were loads of us. There were 25 of us in the room. So it wasn't like just me next to her with a bowl. I was over in the corner. And I actually felt the vibration happen at the same time as a tone of music. And these tools and techniques you can talk to. I'm really interested in biohacking. And I wouldn't call myself a biohacker. But for people who aren't familiar with the expression, these are people who are using every method available to hack their health. So to key into their own health for longevity and to sort of optimize themselves. And that can include extreme stuff like having stem cells replaced over their entire body. They take this stuff called methylene blue, which is actually some sort of fish cleaner, but, you know, it makes you feel alive and alert. And you take sequences of supplements, you inject yourself with peptide. You know, you can go really, really extreme in the biohacking world.
Yeah.
But of all the when I'm talking to biohackers, all of them, all of them talk about light. They talk about heat therapy, so using a sauna. They talk about
like an
nature.
Infrared sauna.
They talk about walking, and they talk about the morning light. So at the front of, you know, all of their techniques and tools, this is what they talk about.
And nearly all of those are very easily accessible.
Exactly. Accessible to us all. Yes.
Yeah. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries.
So we move on then, Julia, to chapter three. It's the place where you learn the most about yourself. And with talking about self-development and getting the best version of ourselves, you know, where comes to mind for that?
So I write about this again in one of the chapters. It's an incredible destination, Iceland. I don't know if you've been.
I have,
but
yeah.
Iceland is geographically fascinating. Is it geologically fascinating?
Yes.
Hundreds of volcanoes and geysers and this incredible...
Like nowhere else, really.
No, and this ever-changing landscape. You know, another volcano erupts, not necessarily a big one like Eyjafjallajökull, but a big one, and there's a new bit of landscape that hasn't been there before. I made a documentary there, so I had to learn, and I got the Icelandics to teach me, how do I say it? And we were walking for hours every day, and I was like, how is it again? I got it wrong for many days, but eventually I got there. Eyjafjallajökull. And my son can say it as well, so that's our claim to fame. That's it. That's the end of my Icelandic knowledge. But while we were there and while we were filming, we were doing part of the Landmannalaugar Trail. We were doing a long five-day trek. Very physically demanding, I would describe it. Not an easy trek, and it's a world destination. You know, bump into Italians and French who camp along the way, and there are these shepherd huts and bigger kind of youth hostel type of huts that people stay in along this route as well. And while I was there, this was in my 30s, I was trying to fall pregnant with my first child, and I've suffered from endometriosis throughout my adult life. And was struggling. And I had, unbeknownst to the crew, in my backpack, I had a pregnancy kit in the backpack, which I needed to test to see if I was pregnant along the way. So I was in this tiny little shepherd's hut long drop lube on the hanging off the side of a volcano, peeing on a stick, nobody knowing what was going on. And unfortunately, it was a negative. It was a no, I wasn't pregnant. So I was very crushed. I was disappointed. I was sort of thinking, you know, am I ever going to fall pregnant? How, you know, what does this mean? And, you know, all these heavy, deep personal feelings that were swirling around. And of course, I couldn't talk to people because I'm not going to tell the crew as much as I knew them. I'm not going to jump out and go, by the way, guys, I'm trying to fall pregnant. And no, and, you know, can I talk to you about it? So I had to process these emotions on my own over the next 3 days of hiking. And I really did learn a lot about myself because I went from being very, very despondent and down and upset and sad, which I think is, you know, I don't give myself a hard time for feeling that. They were appropriate feelings for that moment. But eventually, when we made it to the end of our trail, we encountered all sorts of terrible weather. We crossed icy streams. You know, we were head on into sleet and snow at some of the parts. We were in bubbling hot springs in other parts. It was a fascinating walk. It was incredible, but tough. And I was obviously incredibly happy that we made it, and we made a beautiful documentary. We got to the top of Eyjafjallajökull as well. We managed to get a helicopter up to the top. I know that's not walking, but it was the only way to get up there. It's completely unsafe. It had just erupted and caused chaos around Europe. There was no way to walk because it was a quagmire of dangerous gases and sloping landscapes which were collapsing on each other. So yeah, that was the only way to get to the top. It was a bit like landing on the moon, I would imagine, when we got there. It's like, wow. So we put our feet down into this dark sandy ash, you know, we walked to the end of the precipice and we looked down into this crevice, and we could still hear the ice was still creaking and moving. It was just a unique experience and made great telly as well. And I felt at the end of that night when we were all together as a crew, I just felt on a personal level, you know what, if your body can get through this, if you can manage this kind of a hike, and you know your body is able, then who knows what's possible? Don't discount yourself from falling pregnant, because there's a lot going on in this body that might just get you through. And that was a real learning point, because it helped me psychologically and physically.
You tested your resilience, and you it gave you faith.
Yes, it did. It gave me faith and it gave me hope. And I thought to myself, if I can do this, then maybe, just maybe, I can fall pregnant. And if I don't, then something else will happen. You know, we'll find a way.
And you did.
And we did. I was very lucky. I then did fall pregnant with my son, Zeph, which was just, we called him the miracle baby. I gave birth to Zeph when I was 40, 2 days before my 40th birthday party. So hello, I'm what they call a geriatric mum, which is a lovely term.
A term that we hope that they phase out.
Definitely,
ASAP.
Yes. And then I was desperate for him to have a sibling. I think maybe because being older parents, you think, oh my gosh, are we going to leave him on his own? Or I don't know, it doesn't really make sense. It was an inside feeling. It was a driven emotion rather than it being absolutely practical. And then we went down the IVF route, and that was another interesting journey. We won't go there, but it was three or four rounds of IVF, grueling, heartbreaking, and a real roller coaster. Yes, no, yes, no, and really tough on the body. Really, really tough on the body.
Did walking keep you kind of sane during that time? Because your hormones are all over the shop, and you know, it sounds like it's as you say, it's just such a roller coaster that so many women go through.
Yes, it for me, walking really did help. And I say walking throughout my life has been my outdoor gym, my therapist, and my best friend. And that's the great thing about nature. You can pop into nature and use it as you want. You can be very selfish. You can, you know, stand at the top of a cliff looking out over into the you know, the sea from somewhere beautiful like Cornwall or Devon. And you can scream and shout and, you know, let out some pain if you want to. You can go into a woodland and hug a tree and get a bit of emotional sustenance if you want to. You can power through a landscape really hard if you really need to push yourself physically and this is your exercise of the day. I do that with a weighted vest now, by the way, to add a bit of extra, another dimension to that. So I'm doing my weights as well at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you can really, you can use it to have a good chat with friends. You can catch up. You can have an awkward conversation with friends. You can talk about those uncomfortable family moments on a walk. You can celebrate birthdays. You do. It's there. It's there for you. And we really shouldn't take it for granted. But I think you can be, if you're putting your bit back into it, I think you can be a bit selfish with it sometimes as well.
And in this chapter where we're talking about learning the most about yourself, I wanted to touch on Costa Rica as well, because I know that that was a destination where you found the lump in your breast, which led to then your breast cancer diagnosis, which of course you've spoken a lot about and raised a huge amount of awareness, which of course has done amazing good. But I wondered how you felt about Costa Rica now. Would you ever go back?
Yes, definitely. So I think, you know, when we're preparing for this kind of thing, you get sent through a list of possible questions. So you can just start to think about where you might talk about and what stories you might bring up. And actually, Costa Rica was going to fall into one of my favorite destination questions.
Okay, well, you move it beautifully then there on you to go. Chapter
well, you
four.
You've done it beautifully.
Without knowing it.
Costa Rica, can I list the reasons why I love Costa Rica? Is there enough space on this podcast? It's wildly beautiful, so covered in trees and forests. And 25 or 30 years ago, Costa Rica made the decision, the government made the decision to reinvest all of their military money and their defense money into turning Costa Rica into an eco destination and to let their forests regrow. So David Attenborough, I think, has done a famous piece to camera where he was standing in a place in Costa Rica 25 years ago where there was barely anything behind him. And then he is fast forwards and he's there again 25 years later. And there are mature trees and a forest just thriving behind him. And that's not happening in many places in the world. So I love the forward thinking nature of Costa Rica, that it's made nature its USP, its unique selling proposition. And it's got all sorts of different temperate and rainforests and a real mixture of different forests that it lovingly nurtures and cares for. It runs on something like 98% renewables as well, which is brilliant. They are trying. I know that there are plans afoot for some sort of train system, because one thing that's not so great is that the road system, the infrastructure is not brilliant, and they get around in big polluting, you know, like 4x4s is kind of the only way you can get around. And they're trying to deal with that by putting a train infrastructure, I think it might be electric, in place. So that is addressing that issue. So they're very aware of
and what direct flights from the UK as well.
Yes, direct flights from the UK. So the beaches are incredible, the forests are incredible, and the people are incredible. Pura vida is what they say to you. Pura vida, everywhere you go.
What a thing to say when you meet someone. I mean, pure life. Gorgeous.
Pure life. I mean, and of course, it doesn't just mean pure life. It means hello, it means goodbye, it means yes, it means no, it means everything's sorted. You know, you say, Enrique, has that been sorted? Pura vida. Yes, Julia, pura vida. Done. You know, it means yes, it's all fine. It's just lovely. So
saying that over and over again, like, is hardwiring like happiness into your brain.
It really is. It's that positivity, isn't it? It's that positive affirmation, pura vida, pure life. In fact, I must use it for one of my meditations. That's a really good idea. So I would definitely go back to Costa Rica in a heartbeat. In fact, my dream is one day to have a retreat in Costa Rica. Really? I'd like to move the family and go to Costa Rica and for us to have a Walk Yourself Happy Julia Bradbury retreat there and get people to come there, because it's become this hub of wellness. And there are lots of incredible yoga places in Costa Rica. It has got an amazing energy. The landscape is phenomenal. The food produce is incredible. They have incredible organic farms. They do also, and I haven't researched this properly, but somebody was telling me the other day, they have got a bit of a glyphosate problem. Glyphosate is the most widely used herbicide in the world, but it's pretty toxic. And it goes on lots of our crops, and it's not safe for human consumption. And they believe that it lies at the root of a lot of illnesses, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So just a little...
Largely on wheat here, right?
Yes, largely on wheat here, but used throughout the world, because what it does is when a wheat harvest, for example, when it's harvested, it's stored and there's a fear that it will get moldy. So they spray it to stop it getting moldy. And that's the same with oats and other crops as well. And it's owned by, it's also in a product called Roundup. Roundup is a weed killer. And there are a lot and I know America is a litigious country, but there are thousands and thousands of cases against Monsanto and Bayer, who own Roundup, for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they're being taken to court in America, and they've set aside something like $60 billion to pay off these lawsuits. Mm. So of course you can interpret it, you can say, well, America's litigious and these people are just taking this big company, they're taking them to court to get some money. But when you read them, when you start to read through the stories, the studies, these people are ill. You know, they're not doing it. I mean, you've got people who are at end of life who are trying to get some sort of conversation and to get their story told because they're so ill. So as far as I know, Costa Rica has banned the use of glyphosate in many of its wild national park areas. So there are like 9 or 11 of those. But mm-hmm. there was an article last year in their press where there were calls for them to ban it in agricultural use. So I yep. think it's still in use. And that is just a bit of a worry. But they're not alone. I'm not pinpointing them. It's just, it's strange for me that you've got this beautiful destination, which is known for its ecotourism, and they're regenerating their forests and all the rest of it. But one of these pretty toxic chemicals is still in use in the agricultural field. So I'd like to see that obviously being implemented and glyphosate not being used in Costa Rica or anywhere. Mm. I'd like it to be stopped being used anywhere. Thank you very much.
You would really hope so for the planet's health.
For the soil health, for our health, for Mother Earth's health.
Yeah. We move on to chapter 5, which is your hidden gem. And you were talking about whether you know, we'd do a retreat there. I know that we were chatting before we got started about the retreats that you're starting, and that they would definitely come under the hidden gem category here.
Yes. So my hidden gem is not such a hidden place. It's the Lake District. But the mm-hmm. Lake District means a lot to me because it was my first series of television walks. So I followed in the footsteps of a great walker called Alfred Wainwright, and he's written 13 pictorial guides to the Lake District, which is a place he fell in love with himself. He's not from there, but it was the place that he really fell in love with. He wrote these incredible books, and he did ink drawings, and the Wainwright guides are pretty famous.
Yeah.
So I followed in his footsteps for a TV series, initially for BBC Four, and then they were so warmly received, they all ended up on BBC Two. And then for me, that was the beginning of my walking franchise. It grew and grew and grew, and I took the walks to ITV, and I've done stuff on all around the world and on lots of channels now. So the Lake District is special to me because I've got my dad and Alfred Wainwright to thank for the walks. It's not a hidden gem, but there are lots of hidden gems within the Lake District.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, you could go to the Lake District and you could go every year and you still wouldn't see it all. And you'll still find a hidden little forest or a glade or a glen or a valley or a little, not even a mountain, but a little hill that somebody, you know, you haven't been there before. There's so much to discover. So it's rather beautiful that the first of my Walk Yourself Happy retreats is going to be in the Lake District, because it just makes sense from a story point of view. And we're going to do it in a beautiful location. We're doing it at a boutique hotel called the Coniston Inn, which is really lovely. It's a special. This isn't a youth hostel. It's got, you know, it's got some lovely rooms. They're fully set up for hikers, but there's a nice little posh edge to it. You know, it's a special. It's going to be, the rooms are special, the food is special. And I'm bringing with me some of the experts from my book. So Pauline Cox is an incredible nutritionist. She's going to be designing the menu. So this is going to be a nutritionally healthy, designed, very special menu, which we'll all be eating for 2 days. And it's obviously going to be delicious, but it's also going to be teaching us all, how do we swap sugar out of our diet? What's the healthiest way to start our day? How do you have a healthy breakfast? How do we help with sugary cravings? If we want to lose weight, if that is one of our things, are there ways that we can tweak our diet to help us with that? How do you get off the snacking bandwagon? You know, how can we give up the snacks that we also love and adore? Lisa Pawley will be there, who's this incredible sound therapist and a yoga teacher. So we will be doing some yoga together, but we'll also be doing sound therapy, which is where she plays these incredible crystal bowls and you reverberate to the sound of those. A really special experience.
Oh, it sounds incredible.
It's going to be really, really special.
A complete contrast then. Yeah. Our penultimate chapter, Julia, is go. Your worst travel experience or the place that you'd never go back to.
Well, I don't believe that we should talk about worst travel experiences, because I think travel is such a privilege that there can't be a worst travel experience, because everywhere you go, you meet somebody interesting, you learn something new, it's broadening your horizons. It really is, just as I said, the most extraordinary privilege to be able to do that. It's one of the most extraordinary things that we can do in the 21st century, is to hop on this baked bean can and end up on the other side of the world. And obviously there are issues that go with that. And I'm very aware that if we talk about sustainability and trying to protect Mother Nature and all the rest of it, there's a massive level of hypocrisy that goes with jumping on a plane and going to a destination. That being said, I think you can be a responsible tourist, and I think you can care about the destinations you go to. And I think there are things that you can do to make sure that you are leaving a good mark on the place that you've left, or no mark at all, if that's the best thing to do. And let us remember that the tourism economy is so very important to many, many regions around the world, that it is this is the livelihood for many communities and destinations. So that being said, I think what I can talk about, I wouldn't say this was the worst, but it was funny. I was filming with the Rough Guide crew in India. And we did all of India. We were Kerala, and then we were north, south, east, west. We were in the south, and we had a fixer who had a habit of saying he'd done stuff, but actually it hadn't really been fixed and set up. So what you want when you boots hit the ground, when you're in a different country and you're with a film crew, is the fixer is your point of contact. He or she are everything. They speak the language, they know the people, they know the landscape. So you're really in their hands. And you have a script, you have an idea of what you're going to film, because you have to, from a budgetary point of view, you have to go, okay, well, we need 2 days here, we need 1 day here, we can travel there, we won't be able to get there in time, so we need another extra travel day there. And that's your whole budget and planning, and everything is worked out like that. We were in India, and we were going to trek elephant through this gorgeous southern region, lush, lots of trees and vegetation. And I remember part of the experience, we were traipsing through, and actually I can't believe now, thinking, because I'm quite fearful of snakes, and we were going through quite dense vegetation, and in one stage we kind of waded through a river as well, and I was thinking, I now look back at it going, oh my god, anything could have we got leeches all over us, that we had to get rid of leeches. They were pulled off our feet when we got to one of the destinations. And then the whole plan was that we would go camping in the forest. We would be in this remote part of the forest, and we had a really good chance of seeing elephant in this region if we were up super early and we started to move in the right direction. So we got to what could only be described as sort of it was kind of like a hostel center. You know, it was a green painted bungalow with sort of tea stained pictures on the wall of photographs of various things and bits of information. And it looked like a really, really old, like a scout's hut or something.
Yeah.
So we were in there, and we were like setting ourselves up, and then we got ourselves ready, and we were like, so we had these things to protect our ankles from the leeches, and we had layers that we could take off in case we got too hot. We had our backpacks, which had all our stuff for the night. We had the tent. Oh no, the tents, that they were going to take care of the tents. But you know, we were going off. We were going to trek we were told like 8 hours. Then we'd camp, and then the following morning we'd do everything else. So, and this of course would make great footage as well. Brilliant to be filming through all of this. So we left the hostel place, and we were all in single file, and we've got our leaders out in front of us, and we walked about 600 yards, and we got round some trees, and then there were some tents set up, and he went, there we go, that's where we're camping. And we all looked at him and went, what? Yeah, so this was obviously, he was an Indian, so he was saying it with his Indian accent. No, this is where we're camping. This is our camp for the night. We're going to camp here, and then tomorrow morning we'll move. And we're like, no, we can't just film like a few feet away from the block and pretend we're in the middle of the jungle and that we're then going to go off somewhere else. It's like, it just doesn't work. And that's not what we had agreed and said and all that. Anyway, it was a massive either miscommunication or a big fat lie, who knows what. And we ended up, we were pretty remote. We ended up stuck, and we had to then all share a room on camp beds. There were two camp beds and there were five of us. So we were dossing on the floor and dossing on camp beds, and we had to sleep in this bungalow arrangement. And all we had to eat for dinner were a bag of pickled curried eggs.
So
I have that photograph still of me and the crew, and we're smiling at the camera. It's before selfies, so it wasn't on the, this was taken on a camera, it wasn't taken on a phone. And we're all looking and smiling, and you can see this grim room with peeling paint and, you know, all the rest of it behind us. And we're all holding these eggs, these curried eggs. And going, yeah, we're, you know, on an elephant trek. And that's one of my favourite photographs because it's such a good story. We didn't complete it. We lost the sequence, you know, forget the elephants. That just didn't happen.
Oh, really?
No, because we lost too much time. That's it. We were then a day behind, and we had to get to the next location to film the next thing.
That's so funny. What a brilliant story.
Yeah.
Oh, Julia, it's been so, so lovely to be transported around the world with you today. We're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, chapter 7. That is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list. Where is left for you to discover?
Well, this is actually really easy. And I'm very pleased. I'm 53 and I've made it to this stage in my life with a whole bunch of places that I still want to go to. And isn't that lovely? I hope that before the end of my lifetime, I get to some of them. But I haven't done South America. Oh. I would absolutely love to walk and hike in Chile or Peru or Argentina or the Amazon. You name it. I would love to explore that part of the world on foot. And I have a little thing in my being. I'm quite a positive human being, and I like to think that the time will come, and I just think something is going to happen.
And you're going to manifest it.
I'm going to manifest it, and it will come. It will be a work opportunity, or there will be some really good reason why we as a family have to go there. I mean, the sad thing, having done all this beautiful travel, is that now I have a family, I want to take them back to all of these places. You know, the sad thing is, I'm not sad, I'm lucky and I've done them, but I've done them on my own or with a crew that I really love, some of whom I've never spoken to again. It's a weird thing. You travel to places, you're literally like thrown into a room, sleeping together, eating boiled eggs. And the next thing, you don't see them anymore. Although I do, I'm still in contact with lots of those people actually from that particular trip. So yes, I would love, love, love to do South America. And I'm not picky. I'm not fussy about which part it would be. If it could be all of them, then obviously that would be great. But I'm also not going to pinpoint it down because I don't want to close that opportunity off. I just want to go, Holly, please make it happen. South America.
I will put that energy out there for you as well, Julia, because we'd love to see it on the TV, I'm sure.
Oh, I mean, a walk up the Amazon, how great would that be?
That would be absolutely incredible. Thank you so much, Julia Bradbury. Those were your travel diaries.
Thank you, Holly. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, one of my very favourite conversations. A huge thank you to Julia for joining me on the podcast and inspiring me to embrace how therapeutic nature can be. Julia's Sunday Times bestseller, Walk Yourself Happy, is available from all good bookshops and online. And if you're tempted to book her Lake District retreat, which is called Walk Yourself Happy Wellbeing Retreat, head to theoutdoorguide.co.uk. That's theoutdoorguide.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait till then, remember there's the first 10 seasons to catch up on. That's over 115 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb.
It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.